I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Menachem Hesse, the Minister for Science and Cultural Affairs at the Israeli Embassy in Washington, D.C. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, we celebrated the Jewish festival of Shavuot, which commemorates the giving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. Although Shavuos is technically a major Jewish festival, one of the three great pilgrimage holidays in the Torah, it's often a kind of stepchild among the plethora of Jewish holy days, coming as it does in the early summer and zooming by in just a day or two. But Shavuot does bring some very important ideas and concepts up that are well worth discussing, even a few days after the festival of Torah and cheesecake. First, the very word Torah, which is so central to Judaism, is often misunderstood. Typically translated as law, Torah actually means teaching, and a special sort of teaching at that. Torah is really a process, learning and teaching rolled into one, the mutual experience of exploring an idea or a text with other people in order to see how it might improve your own life or our shattered world. Torah is a dialectical process, a dialogue or conversation on the subject of God, human beings, meaning, holiness, ethics, morality, ritual, and many other subjects, history too, I guess, a nearly magical process that engages the intellect and the heart at the same time. By talking, listening, discussing, reading, and engaging in this ancient yet continually fresh process, we have the opportunity to grow personally and spiritually. We learn from our texts and from our fellow students and teachers, and we teach them as well. There is no better way to grow individually than through the process of Torah, and there is no better way to help your community develop depth and purpose than through this sacred yet dynamic and constantly interesting experience. Whether you're trying to figure out what you personally believe about the origins of the universe, exploring the complexity of being an effective parent or role model, discussing the merits of capital punishment, or wondering whether the concept of holiness has a place in your world in the year 2014, the act of doing Torah itself, of reading, unpacking, discussing, arguing about, connecting, and separating important ideas and instructions in ways that make them relevant and interesting, brings great value to life and great values into your life. Now, I realize that as a rabbi, I'm not actually unbiased on the subject of studying Torah. After all, rabbi means teacher, and more specifically, someone who is supposed to be a master of Torah, whose knowledge base and the warrant for his or her authority as a scholar rests primarily on understanding Torah. But you don't have to be a rabbi to enjoy and appreciate what the study of this seminal text can do for anyone and everyone. Secondly, in Judaism, we understand this word Torah in a rich and wide variety of ways. It means the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, of course, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, but it also refers to the whole text of the Bible, the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, which we know as the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. All of these diverse books have something to teach us. Each one of the books in the Bible has virtues that range from the literary to the philosophical, from the aesthetic to the comedic. In addition, there is an entire oral Torah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, that incorporates over 2,000 years of brilliant minds interacting with this great text to discover how it can apply in very different settings and in new and sometimes novel ways. In essence, studying Torah means utilizing the collective and creative wisdom of thousands of years of smart Jewish minds and caring Jewish hearts, applying their talents to making life meaningful and special. That's what Torah is. That's what makes Judaism unique among religious traditions and cultures, immersed in learning and evolving to help us live lives of beauty, meaning, and blessing. Not a bad lesson from the holiday of Shavuot last week, and in fact a very good way to spend some part of every week, even every day of your life. To play us in on this subject of Torah, here's a Hasidic Kaddish technically called the Kaddish Darabanan, the Scholar's Kaddish, from the group Safam, a praise of God and of those who study and teach Torah. That was Safam and Cantor Dan Fung singing the Hasidic Kaddish. This coming week, I'll be leading a pilgrimage tour to Israel and will visit a variety of remarkable places, both ancient and modern. This morning on Too Jewish, our guest will discuss some of those contemporary accomplishments. Israel is a cutting-edge nation in many scientific and agricultural areas, and it maintains and is rapidly developing new partnerships with American universities and corporations in remarkable ways. Find out about this important but little understood process when we return in a few moments with the Minister of Science and Agricultural Affairs, Menachem Hesse, from the Israeli Embassy in Washington, D.C., but right here on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it, visit asu.edu.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. He's Minister Menny Hesse, who serves as the Minister for Agriculture and Science Affairs at the Embassy of Israel in Washington, D.C., and is accredited really throughout North America, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Welcome to Two Jewish. Tell us a little bit about what your portfolio is and what that means for your work.
You know, Israel is the on agricultural matters, it has lots of history. The ancient history, of course, of historically in the region, but the state of Israel was established on the basis of agriculture, and the we used to be a developing country, and it was only 65 years ago.
Right.
And today we are already a developed country, which is, as we say, a miracle for itself.
It is a miracle in such a short period of time.
But you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu said a while ago that it's in a way it's a shame that Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moses brought us. Took him 40 years to bring us to the only place without oil in the Middle East.
Yes, but now there's natural gas, so maybe now, it's not so bad.
Yeah, now we have natural gas, but I think that the gap between, in the way, the 65 years between the establishment of the State of Israel and today, it's the most important thing to the State of Israel, because we learned how to do more with less, and we didn't have any other choice. We barely have trade with our neighbors. We had to import food, and there was time that we could not even buy food around the world. It was a huge issue in Israel, and as I mentioned, we were a developing country and we had to struggle over the years, but we had to produce our own food. Now 60% of the state of Israel is desert, and how do you do that? So up to date, today we have the knowledge and the ability to produce in places that around the world now struggle to produce their own food. Now, we have already, for example, with the United States, we have a mutual agreement, bilateral agreement, of mutual research. And I'm talking on agreement from 78, 79. And we did already...
30-some years.
Approximately 35 years.
35 years, right?
Yes. And we had already 1,200 corporations on research, on mutual research. And I must say that this one...
Now, these are agricultural joint projects between Israel and the United States.
Yes, correct. This is a fund, a mutual fund called BARD, B-A-R-D. And BARD has a principal fund that makes profits. And besides it, we have a matching fund every year. The State of Israel and the United States of America, the USDA, put cash money for research, mutual research. Now, this one comes from the idea that first... we are partners, so we give money to make research. With the other side, we give money as well, dollar for dollar. Uh-huh. But more than that, we'll take only research, we'll make $3 out of that. So 1 plus 1 equals 3.
$1 becomes $3 in research.
1 plus 1 equals 3.
Yes, sorry.
Because each side...
Each side puts in a dollar, and then there's another dollar in matching money. Yeah. The we will talk much more, but I don't think most American Jews... I think most Americans know how much cooperative work there is between Israel and the United States in the area of agriculture, and we will explore a little bit more about that Israeli miracle and how it came about when we come back this morning on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So Shavuot was last week, and Shavuot in America goes by, and it's one day or 2 days if you're conservative or Orthodox. People often miss that it's a major holiday. It's a major holiday, receiving of the Ten Commandments at Sinai. But in Israel, in addition to being one of the Shalosh Regalim, the pilgrimage festivals, it's an important holiday for kibbutzim. Talk a little bit about how they've kind of reworked Shavuot over the last 100 years.
Yeah, actually, it's one of the high holiday, if not the high holiday for the kibbutzim, because it's also the, how do you say, harvest holiday?
Usually,
it's the time that you
Chag HaSif,
collect,
the gathering
so
of the crops.
So, of course, kibbutzim were mainly agriculture, so it was the time that you'll bring all the tnuvat hasadeh and
the
to show it,
of the
produce
fields.
Of the field,
right.
And even the first babies of the year.
Ah.
I lived 8 years at the kibbutz, so every Shavuot, we will bring the new kid that was born, and we will go, we'll do tahalucha, we'll do a parade of the wheat, pomegranate, babies, all the new
How
things
fun.
So it's really unique in Israel. It's the most, I think, popular secular holiday, because I'm not sure all those who celebrate Shavuot goes to the synagogue first or
sure.
the night before and
or study all night, like
all tikkun
is.
Shavuot or whatever. But
so
it's very popular. Usually there is a lot of fairs that related to Shavuot, mm-hmm. all kind fairs for teens, for chaklaim, like farmers fairs mm-hmm. for 2 or 3 days.
Anybody so, employed in agriculture, it's
yeah.
a festival, major festival.
Yeah.
You were mentioning before we went on the air about a custom that I never heard of before, which is the sprinkling of water on Shavuot. Can you explain what happens?
Yeah, can I invite our Israeli audience to reply to you? And it's
Please.
Not just in Beit She'an. Yeah, usually since I'm like a little, very little kid, we used to take a shopping bag, fill them with water and
the
wait.
The plastic shopping bags
yeah,
filled
plastic,
them with water.
Yeah, plastic, yeah, or other sandwich, whatever.
Some kind of bag.
And waiting for people to come back from synagogue, like on the Shavuot day, and just throw on them the water. Yeah.
So it was like water balloon festival. Now, all I can think of is two things. Either that's traditional. You were mentioning maybe because you're supposed to study Torah like water. It should just flow all the time, and that's the symbolic meaning. Or maybe because in Beit She'an, it's a really hot place in Israel, and it was hot coming back
so
from synagogue
So why it's not in Tucson the same? It's hot
well,
here.
So we could add that tradition. I would like to invite any Israeli listeners or people who've been in Israel for Shavuot, I have, but only in Jerusalem, to contact us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com and tell us if this is an experience you've ever had on Shavuot, getting water tossed on you when you came back
to
synagogue.
Yeah, please contact us.
All right. Well, we hope it was a great Shavuot, and we look forward to a beautiful summer of great produce in that spirit.
Tada.
Thanks, Oshvat. We'll talk next
week.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We celebrated the great Covenant Festival of Shavuot last week, kind of the last big Jewish holiday of this 5774 year, unless you count Tisha B'Av. Let's talk a little bit about maybe what Shavuot has to teach us, even in the retrospective view.
Right. Well, you know, as I once confessed on the air, Shavuot is the holiday that I shamefully tend to forget about.
Yes.
Because it's short and...
Well, so it's good that we're doing this after Shavuot.
We don't have lots of customs associated with it. We stay up all night, study Torah. We eat dairy foods and particularly cheese blintzes for reasons that have never been clear to me. but the... You know, Torah is central to the notion of being Jewish, whether you regard being Jewish as a religion, an ethnicity, a nation, a culture, a history, a community, however you define being Jewish, or in the case of this show, being too Jewish, Torah is central to the notion of Jewishness. And, you know, for some people, it's just a book. And it's a book worth studying and worth reading. It's a great piece of literature. It's a piece of history. It has some morality in it, but it's a book. I think what Shavuot has to teach us is that it's part of our contract with God or with the divine or with the universe, that being the people of the book implies somehow that we belong to it as much as it belongs to us, and that it imposes certain obligations on us. Now, obviously, being Jews, we all have different interpretations of what those obligations are. But most people would agree that identifying yourself as a Jew means accepting certain obligations, whether it's an obligation to observe Shabbat or the dietary laws, or simply to engage in tikkun olam and making the world a better place. Everybody who accepts the sort of the yoke of Torah somehow accepts the notion that it implies certain obligations and a contractual relationship with the universe of give and take, and that we're not here just to play and party.
You know, the whole notion of covenant is a contract, that we're in sort of a contract with God. It works both ways. And that means that we are obligated to try to see what the best way to live is and to try to live to that standard. So that's not a bad lesson, no matter what your faith or what your practice.
I totally agree.
Thank you, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe is talking to his psychiatrist. "I had the weirdest dream," he said. "I saw my mother, but then I noticed she had your face. This dream bothered me so much I woke up and I couldn't get back to sleep. I just lay in bed thinking about it until 7 a.m. I got up, made myself a slice of toast and coffee, and came right here. Please, doctor, can you help me explain the meaning of my dream?" The psychiatrist is silent for a moment and then says, "One slice of toast and coffee? That you call breakfast?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well and listen to your mother on the subject of breakfast, would you? And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha from the Book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout the land and see if it could be captured. The spies take a month, and they see the whole land. And they report back to Moses, the land is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it must be carried by two men on a pole, now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything is gonna be great, only it's not. 10 of the 12 spies next report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say, and numerous. The cities are fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance of taking the land in spite of God's support. Two spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report, saying that with God's help the land can be taken, but the Israelites are too terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, "Why did you take us out of slavery only to kill us here at the hands of our enemies?" It's at this point that God makes a decision. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in one generation. And so, after a failed leaderless attempt to invade the land without God's approval or Moses' leadership, the people are condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 additional years, a total of 40 since they left Egyptian slavery, until a new young generation can emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a mentality that comes from growing up in freedom. It's a great lesson in the process that's required to cleanse the trauma of failure from the minds of a community. Often it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or a country. It's the generational turn that comes from learning that things can be done differently and that freedom is a birthright. May we remember that great lesson this week and each week. Israeli technology for doing agriculture in the desert is likely the best in the world. Israel uses a higher percentage of its water efficiently than any country on earth. Israel is at the forefront of a variety of other technology fields, ranging from medical imaging to software encryption, and Israel is an open society that actively seeks mutually beneficial partnerships with American organizations, educational institutions, and companies. So, how does Israel do this? And why would that be good for the United States? Find out from our guest this morning, Menachem Hesse, the Minister of Agricultural and Science Affairs at the Israeli Embassy in Washington, when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The suspect arrested in the attack last month at the Jewish Museum in Brussels that left four dead just before Memorial Day weekend was a French-born jihadist who had returned home from fighting in Syria. European governments and Jewish institutions are trying to cope with a new danger of European jihadists coming home from Syria and its terrible civil war with deadly new skills, terrorist fervor, and malicious intentions. There has been a change. It requires us to fundamentally reconsider the degree of threat posed to Jewish targets not only in France but across Europe, said Sami Gozlan, a French former police officer and president for the National Bureau of Vigilance Against Antisemitism there. That is the only way to prevent attacks like the one in Brussels. Last week in Marseille, police arrested Mehdi Nemouche, 29 years old, on suspicion that he had carried out the May 24th attack on the Jewish Museum in Belgium. French police found an assault rifle, a handgun, and a small video camera in Nemouche's bag. Nemouche, who was born on France's border with Belgium, traveled via Brussels in the year 2012 to fight with a jihadist in Syria's civil war. Western intelligence agencies have long feared that European Muslims fighting in Syria will return and commit terror attacks in their own home countries. French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said in January that the threat of jihadists returning to Europe is the greatest danger we must face in the coming years. It's a phenomenon of unprecedented size. Gozlan has called on his government to revoke the citizenship not only of jihadists who leave to fight, but also their families. Our synagogues and schools already resemble fortresses, he said. It's time for the perpetrators, not the victims, to fear for their families. France already has hardened its line on French nationals who undergo Islamist indoctrination and weapons training abroad as part of its own security services' response to the actions of Mohamed Merah, the 23-year-old Muslim terrorist from Toulouse who in 2012 killed three soldiers and four Jews. Merah, who died in a shootout with police, he'd had a booby-trapped apartment as well, had undergone training in Pakistan and Afghanistan, visited Syria and Jordan 2 years before the murders. He had surveyed and filmed Toulouse's Or HaTorah Jewish school days before he killed three children and the rabbi there. We will continue to follow this ongoing and disturbing story from Europe. Henry Ford, the legendary founder of Ford Motor Company, one of the great innovators in American business history, who is also one of the great anti-Semites in U.S. history, is undoubtedly spinning in his grave right about now. Because his own Ford Motor Company, which bears his name and in which his family still has a substantial interest, has a new CEO, whose name is Mark Fields, and whose family's original name was Finkelman, and Mark Fields, the new CEO of Ford, is Jewish. When Ford named Fields as its president and CEO on May 1st, the 53-year-old executive became not just the first Jew to run Ford, but the first Jew to head any major U.S. automaker. Jeffrey Gurak, a professor of Jewish history at Yeshiva University, said, "I don't think Henry Ford would have dreamed of a day where a Jew would be the head of his motor company. Part of his anti-Semitism was that Jews would control but not work. He never would have dreamed there would be a Jew putting people to work in the Ford Motor Company." I wonder how many RPM he is spinning in his grave now. Fields was born in Brooklyn, raised in New Jersey, graduated from Harvard Business School after doing a stint at IBM. He signed on at Ford in an era when many of his classmates, Jewish and otherwise, headed for potentially more lucrative jobs on Wall Street. Fields says, "I wanted to work for a company that made things." The newly minted CEO adds that he joined Ford because he liked their cars and was impressed with the company's products overall.
Mark Fields' predecessor as CEO of Ford, Alan Mulally, relied heavily on a strategy that Fields drew up when he was a senior executive in 2005. At the time, Ford's big North American division was losing lots of money. In fact, between 2005 and 2008, it posted losses of more than $30 billion. Fields' plan called for closing factories, laying off workers, and using Ford's design expertise in Europe to build better cars that could be sold globally. He's also been an advocate within the company for advanced technology and better products. Ford pulled through that crisis. Its two rivals, Chrysler and GM, had to have bankruptcy protection. But between 2009 and 2013, Ford earned more than $42 billion in profits. "Every job the company's ever asked Mark Fields to do, he's done a really good job of it," said William Clay Ford Jr., the company's current executive chairman and great-grandson and heir to Henry Ford. Still, back in 89, when Fields joined Ford, it was hardly the obvious choice for an ambitious junior executive who was Jewish. The company has a history of attracting talented executives, but despite years of trying to make amends for its founder's anti-Semitism, it has long labored under the legacy of Henry Ford. Henry Ford was known for his ownership of the Dearborn Independent, the Michigan-based paper he bought in 1918 and proceeded to fill with rabidly anti-Jewish invective, including a 91-part series later bound into a book under Ford's name called The International Jew. Forcefully distributed to Ford dealerships nationwide in the 1920s, Ford's paper gained an unprecedented readership for anti-Semitism in America. In some places, the dealership would actually put copies of the newspaper in the cars so that when you drove off with your Model T, you had on the seat next to you a copy of the Dearborn Independent and its anti-Semitic stuff, said Hasia Dinner, professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU. Ford also distributed some 500,000 copies of The International Jew across America and, with more lethal effect, published it in Europe. Adolf Hitler and other Nazis hailed Henry Ford for his anti-Semitic stand. The Nazi Party distributed his book in translation throughout Germany. In 1938, the Nazi regime awarded Henry Ford the Grand Cross of the German Eagle in recognition of his anti-Semitic work. As one of the most famous men in America, Henry Ford legitimized ideas that otherwise would have been given little authority here. Henry Ford II, who hated his grandfather, was the one who moved to make amends after World War II. He developed a close business and personal relationship with Max Fischer, the Detroit-based national Jewish communal leader, businessman, and philanthropist, and with Max Fischer's encouragement, gave freely to Jewish causes around Detroit. Henry Ford II also made gigantic gifts to the then United Jewish Appeal. But it wasn't until the late 1970s that an executive who was Jewish, Mervyn Manning, was promoted to vice president in one of Ford's subdivisions. In 1999, Benson Ford Jr., a great-grandson of Henry Ford, gained plaudits, donating a 500-year-old Sephardic Torah to Temple Shir Shalom in West Bloomfield, Michigan, Detroit suburb. The new Ford CEO, Mark Fields' own grandparents, came to America from Russia and Romania. In America, the family name Finkelman became Fields. His parents were members of a conservative shul in Paramus, New Jersey. Mark Fields has said that he never experienced any anti-Semitism during his 25 years at Ford. Mazel tov to the new Jewish CEO of Ford.
Well, she got her daddy's car and she cruised through the hamburger stand now. Seems she forgot all about the library like she told her old man. The radio blast and goes cruising just as fast as she can now. And she'll have fun, fun, fun till her daddy takes a T-Bird away.
In not such great news, Israel issued tenders for the construction of some 1,500 homes and apartments in East Jerusalem and the West Bank last week. This was widely viewed as an act of retaliation for the formation of the Palestinian Unity Government that includes Hamas, which has been officially labeled a terrorist group by both Israel and the United States and other countries as well. Housing Minister Uri Ariel of the Beit Hayudi, the Jewish Home Party, says the move is a fitting Zionist response to the formation of a Palestinian terror government. The announcement of new housing construction is just the beginning. These units will reportedly be built in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Ramat Shlomo, as well as Efrat, Beitar Elite, Adam, and Givat Zev in the West Bank. The U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, condemned the announcement of the new housing tenders. "We oppose construction in the settlements and this type of announcement about building. This would happen with or without the disagreement on the new Palestinian transitional government," Shapiro said. Now it cuts like a knife. And a new study from Canada indicates a possible connection between male circumcision and a lower likelihood of prostate cancer. The study, published in the British urology journal BJU International, was based on interviews of more than 3,000 men in Montreal between the ages of 40 and 75. The study's authors found that men who had been circumcised, whether in infancy or later in life, had lower rates of prostate cancer than those who had not. Overall, the study found that circumcised men were 11% less likely to develop prostate cancer than those who were not circumcised. Good for the Bris. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's Minister Manny Hesse, Minister for Agriculture and Science Affairs at the Embassy of Israel in Washington, D.C. He's also an attorney. We will forgive him for that. Before being posted to Washington, he was a legal advisor at the Israeli Tax Authority, so this is a guy you want to be careful with also. He was responsible, however, for international trade procedures and policies and harmonizing tariff systems and a variety of other occupations. Very bright, very interesting guy, visiting the United States. Welcome again. Tell us a little bit about the way that these partnerships, we talked at the beginning of the show about the way there's agricultural partnerships, and many of them, 1,200 you said, since 1978, between the United States and Israel. How do they evolve? How do companies, individuals, how does it work?
Okay, you don't want to get too much into the technical,
sure, sorry,
technical side, but because I believe that the essence is much more important here.
Sure.
And the thing is that we have a mutual board, three Americans, three Israelis, and the chairman is actually in Israel, but we have a balance more or less between all 50 states that make and universities. They make this cooperation in Israel. Now the Ministry of Agriculture in Israel has an organization called Volcani Center, which is agriculture research organization, which makes approximately 70% of the research in agriculture in Israel. Of course, we have Weizmann Institute, we have Hebrew University, Tel Aviv University, etc. And we start to broad the cooperation between...
So you're broadening the cooperation.
Yeah, between all kind of research institutions here. So for example, here in Arizona and in Nevada, you see now they're dealing with water problems that we had in the past in Israel, but here...
Yeah, terrible drought. Now in California, yeah. Tremendous drought problems,
yes,
as well.
And of course. And we see what happens here and in other states as well. Now in Israel, we have lots of water solutions. And we are willing to... you know, Maimonides once says it's the highest level of...
Of tshuva, of tzedakah.
Of tzedakah is making a partnership. Right. Now, we're not giving any tzedakah and we're not getting any tzedakah. But we do believe in cooperation and we don't have all of the knowledge. And my colleagues in Israel always say we're not smarter, we just didn't have any other option. And scarcity
is our only choice. So.
And scarcity is the mother of innovation.
Yeah.
We didn't have any other option. So today we're going to make a research and here the climate is a different climate from Israel.
Sure.
So this cooperation we are going to enhance will make benefits to Israel and to United States of America and other states as well we try to cooperate with.
I want to talk a little bit about, as you noted, necessity is the mother of invention. Israel had to grow crops in the desert because so much of Israel is desert. Israel is renowned for really creating drip irrigation. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other aspects of how Israelis have dealt with this desert problem?
Okay, so maybe a surprising fact. Today in Israel we have too much water. Which
That is a surprising fact.
It's a surprising fact, but it's a shame because the prices rose up as well. But
of desalination?
Okay, so one of the main reasons is desalination. So I would like to remind that 20 years ago, we didn't have enough water.
Right.
And then we established the Palestinian Authority, and we wanted to sign an agreement with Jordan as well. And part of this agreement, we had to supply water to them as well. How do you do that?
Well, I mean, it was fascinating because I remember being in Israel and people watching the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, decline and go lower and lower, and Israel was going to run out of water. It was a terrible problem.
Yeah, and I must mention that we call it Sea of Galilee, but actually it's won't be even considered to be a lake here.
Yes.
You know, it's very
not,
small.
Not quite the size of Lake Michigan.
It's a small lake. Yeah, it's a very small lake, and everybody in Israel were brought up in a way that you know you're tracing the red line.
Right.
And I remember maybe one or two times when I was a child when it was above the red line.
It's always below the red line, which is when there's a crisis for water in Israel.
So today we barely use this. And one of the reasons is desalination. We have the biggest factories in Israel for desalination. And I would like to remind as well that during the 90s we had million immigrants from Russia coming to Israel.
Right.
And we were afraid that we are not going to be able to support.
Yeah, and plus another 50,000 or 100,000 from Ethiopia and elsewhere.
Yes, of course.
Population growth, and yet how did so really this is kind of a water miracle to go with the agriculture.
So I would say it's not miracle; it's efficiency.
Okay.
For example, there is a term called effluent water, maybe in regular terms.
Wastewater, they call it.
It's wastewater. You can call it sewage. Okay, and we use for agriculture purposes today. And this is 2014, 80% of the effluent water in Israel. 80%, 80. Okay?
What percentage do you think the United States uses by comparison?
1%. So you see there is a huge difference. Now, it's not that easy to do it. And in 5 to 7 years, we're going to be approximately 90% as well. So.
And at that point, there's probably a diminishing returns.
Yeah, it's... One of the things is that you want to use what you have, the resources that you already have. And these are water that's wastewater. So we're trying to reclaim as much as water as you can for agriculture purposes and other purposes. What about industry? And if we have exports, for example, from Israel, and you have to prepare to produce with water, then actually we export water as well, besides giving water to supplying water to Jordan and Egypt as well. Now, on the way, we didn't have this desalination solutions, and this technology was actually a new technology. We didn't have the option even to make. And I would like to remind that it was a huge discussion in Israel how to bring water to Israel to wash. And one of the suggestions was to drag a glacier from Turkey.
I remember that discussion.
Okay, it was.
Turkey has glaciers?
There. Maybe we had to invent glaciers in Turkey then. But we had to find...
I think that would be newsworthy.
Well, we had to find a solution how to bring a massive amount of water.
A lot of water in, right?
And there was a discussion because it's going to be melted as well.
Sure.
And how to preserve it in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Okay. It's,
in a warm climate. Huge.
So eventually, and floods that could happen. Eventually, we didn't do that.
Probably the right choice.
But the prices, of course, the prices of water rose up.
Because desalination is an expensive process. Yes, it takes a lot of energy, right?
Energy, and the factories work on capacity. You have to manufacture. You cannot manufacture as much as you want.
So you have to have enough factories to be able to meet your peak need, not necessarily just a certain steady supply.
Yeah, and I spoke before about the effluent water as well. Mm-hmm. You know that to use the water, most of the population of Israel is in Tel Aviv. That's the highest place.
Yeah, the coastal strip.
So the agricultural areas are not in Tel Aviv.
Right.
So you have to transfer water from one place to another. It costs, besides purifying the water.
You also have to move it.
Treating the water, you have to transfer the water as well. And transferring costs money as well. And that costs here as well. Now you ask people in Israel, and I was born in Israel. When you ask people in Israel, everybody has someone who live in Israel. On the daily life, people in Israel save money. Each family in Israel save money. Saving money means saving water here. Okay, saving water, saving resources. And how do they do that? For example, and this is something very basic, when you brush your teeth living in Israel, you're going to turn off the running water.
Because you know it's expensive.
We know it's expensive, and we know we...
And it's important a resource to the country.
It's a resource that we don't have enough from.
Right.
and for when you take a shower.
So conservation is really built into the culture.
I would say it's a huge educational process to teach people that this is a resource that you cannot buy as much as you want. It's a resource. You are in shortage.
Yeah. It's fascinating. In dealing with, because not only water, but also the agricultural basis, Israel used to be an agricultural country. I mean, it went from nothing. We talked before the show about Rishon LeZion, you know, and the founding of the first agricultural settlements in Israel, and what a expensive and really difficult proposition that was. Now, when you look at Israel, you know, it has a reputation as a great agricultural producer. They make all kinds of crops. Obviously, the whole market isn't Israel. It's now an export economy, and it was since the days of Jaffa oranges, which I'm not sure they even grow anymore. Who is Israel's primary market, and what affects that market?
Okay, so the main market today, up to date, for Israel is Europe, and it varies. Of course, we're trying to open new markets, and we have Israel is one of the states that has the most free trade agreements around the world. And the we used to be on number one, but yeah, some states, you know, did work as well, and there is lots of competition. But the thing with Israel that we don't work just with exports of fresh produce, even though we do export lots of fresh produce as well. But we export knowledge. When you cannot trade with the neighbors around, you don't have, again, it's scarcity.
No free trade agreements with Syria. Egypt is very limited.
Not yet. We hope that in the future. But the,
God willing, as we say.
God willing. And the for example, one of the things, maybe it's easier to say it over here, that we have this year, October 2014, we're going to have the World Dairy Summit in Israel. And the, all of the industry around the world and the policymakers around the world are going to gather in Israel to hear and to teach about the improvement in the dairy market around the world. But Israel has a huge relevant advantage from knowledge here that we made during the years. And you should know that the Israeli cow produced 12,000 kilograms of milk a year, which is much, much higher than the average here in America, even.
Israel, you know, the stereotype was the kibbutznik, you know, in sandals farming. Nowadays, the stereotype of the Israeli is a high-tech entrepreneur in suburban Tel Aviv. Has that affected, you know, there seems to me a lower percentage of Israelis are employed in agriculture than before. Has that been compensated for simply with efficiencies, or is there actually a danger of not having enough agricultural workers in Israel?
This is a trend. It's a worldwide trend in Western world countries.
In the United States, too, of course.
Of course, yes. It's a trend, and we see it, and I think that the world has been changed. I think that it has its impact that, you know, now we work with more machines, and we need maybe less produce here and there. And,
more technology.
And we have more technology, and this is a natural process. Now, I believe that even here in the States, the government, as in Israel, struggle to structure the future of the agriculture, and to be able to self-produce to a limited amount of what you need in the future. So we didn't get to this point in Israel, but maybe in the future we'll be in this point, and we'll have to.
What? It's a fascinating subject. I want to thank Meni Hesse for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I'm sure you could tell us a great deal more about development of science in addition, but thank you for a great visit on agriculture, and best of luck.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Professor Sharon Megdahl, one of the foremost experts in the world on water use and an expert on water use in Israel. Our playout this morning comes from cantors David Propus and Alan Naplin. It's a nigun, a wordless song for the Sabbath. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavuot Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Yai dai 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 d